KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Hopworks Urban Brewery, offering sustainable brews and local food for 10 years, serving the community at three locations: Hopworks Urban Brewery on Southeast Powell Boulevard, Bike Bar at North Williams Avenue, and in Vancouver on Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard. More information online at hopworksbeer.com. It is 5 o'clock, and coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an estimated 25,000 supporters of teachers rallied at Waterfront Park today in support of education reform.
Portlanders have a unique role to play in saving the starving killer whales in the Puget Sound of Washington State.
And the Portland City Council learned of a loophole in their vote to leave the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 8th, 2019. I'm Emily Gresham Beamer.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. 600 Oregon schools were closed today as teachers, students, and parents rallied for the state senate to increase funding for education. Organized by the Oregon Education Union, the walkout is the latest in a wave of actions inspired by the nationwide Red for Ed movement, which began in Virginia last year. 25,000 people gathered to march through downtown Portland as simultaneous protests took place in Salem, Eugene, Medford, Bend, and Klamath Falls. A lack of Senate Republican attendance on the Senate floor has made it impossible to vote on the tax legislation proposed in House Bill 3427. The new legislation proposes business sales tax of about $1 million to be taxed by an increase of 0.57%. KBOO's Jenkins Soderberg brought back this audio from the scene.
Ladies and gentlemen, Lily Eskelson Garcia, your NEA president.
25,000 of you here in this park. And you are about to make history, boys and girls. And the best kind of history you can make is the history that makes something better in the lives of a child.
What made you decide to come out to this event today?
Well, we're trying to support getting more funding into our schools so we can support having more programs or get our programs back. More school counselors, smaller students in classes. I know at my school we have a lot of class sizes that are 35, 40, 45. And my son's class last year had 31 students in it in second grade, you know, stuff like that. So we need smaller classes and more funding for programs and counselors and other things.
Wow. Is that 35 students with one teacher?
Yes.
Without an aide.
With no aide.
Right.
And what about the counselor situation?
Well, so in high school, I know our caseloads are about 500 to 1. And in the elementaries, they can be up anywhere between 700, 800 to 1, even more in some districts.
Are you you're a school counselor?
I am a school counselor, yes.
And so has this been a big problem for you to have such a big caseload?
Well, it just makes it impossible to do everything we need to do all the time, you know? So we do our best, but yeah, it's not the best we can do for kids. My name is Molly Ninneman.
Thank you, Molly.
Thank you. I just want a PE teacher because our school doesn't have a PE teacher, and our teacher has to do all the work for a PE teacher.
You don't have a PE teacher at all? So what do you do when it's time for PE?
We go out on the field and just, we'll go out on the field and just play.
Wow, I bet you would like to have a PE teacher, huh? Do you think that the government can do something better than what they're doing now?
Yes.
You say, I am the future on your shirt.
I am the future.
My name is Audrey Patterson. I'm a third and fourth grade teacher at Sitton Elementary in St. John's.
What do you think about the Republican legislators just kind of staying out of the Capitol so they don't have to vote on this?
I think that's horrible. This is all of our future. You know, our students are our future. And if they decide that they don't want to vote on it, I think that that's kind of a slap in the face to teachers. So the Student Success Act taxes corporations that make over $1 million a year, and that does not include a tax on food, and it actually gives a tax break to people that make less than $250,000. So it's just getting those corporations to pay their fair share. And help support your teachers, help support our students.
Oregon lawmakers have confirmed that bike lanes still exist even when interrupted by an intersection, despite the absence of lane markings on the roadway. The Oregon Senate voted on House Bill 2682 on Monday to clarify the state's definition of a bike lane. They added language stating that the lane, quote, exists in an intersection if the bicycle lane is marked on opposite sides of the intersection in the same direction of travel. The bill is a significant victory for bicycling advocates, who called this their top priority in the 2019 legislative session. According to the nonprofit bicycling and pedestrian advocacy group, the Street Trust, in two previous cases, judges had determined drivers who hit bicyclists had not violated any right-of-way laws because bike lanes were not marked in the intersections. House Bill 2682 clarifies the requirement that motorists yield to cyclists who are riding through an intersection before turning. The bill now heads to Governor Kate Brown's desk to be signed into law.
The Oregon legislature has taken up a bill that would let farmers sue companies such as Bayer and Syngenta that hold patents on genetically engineered seeds if crops grown from those seeds contaminate other crops. House Bill 2882 would allow landowners or tenants to seek 3 times actual economic damages if GE organisms, also called GMOs, are present on their land without permission. The Statesman Journal reports contamination from genetically engineered crops can make organic and conventional crops unable to be sold. GE crops can also escape their fields and become a nuisance for other farmers, that is almost impossible to eradicate. It would also allow residents to sue the corporations if GE organisms are found on land owned or occupied by a public body in the area where they live. The legislation is nearly identical to a bill considered in the 2017 legislative session. That bill died in committee.
A Portland environmental advocate is kicking off a series of demonstrations today in support of the southern resident killer whale population in the Puget Sound of Washington State. Their informational picket will be across the street from Powell's Books on Burnside tonight until 7 p.m. Michelle Settleman of the Sea Shepherd Society in Portland spoke with KBOO's Lisa Loving about why Portland is a key constituency in saving the whales.
So the southern resident killer whale population that live in the Puget Sound and also along the coast of Oregon are in dire straits of starvation. They primarily feed on Chinook salmon. 80% of their diet is Chinook, 20% is chum, and they've been eating this for thousands and thousands of years. And we basically have, because of the dams on the rivers, the overfishing, and the pollutants, the salmon runs are down to 3% of their native run. And because of that, the southern resident killer whales are starving to death. And I don't know if you heard about Mama Taliqua last year, who carried her deceased baby on her back for 17 days. And every time she made a choice to take a breath, she had to put the baby down, breathe, and pick the baby up for 17 days. She did that while her family and her grieved another loss of a southern resident. So they're quite sentient beings, and they really need our support. And my goals, speaking separately from Sea Shepherds, because I'm actually working on this as an individual, and I do run Sea Shepherds Portland, but I'm doing this as an individual. I really, and thousands of us, are trying to get them to remove the lower dams on the Snake River. These dams provide only surplus power. They're being sold at a cost to ratepayers to California because it's surplus power. And they've been on the table for removal for 2 decades, because this has been going on for 2 decades. They were very controversial when they were put in the beginning. And they also were taken from the indigenous people. And so for so many reasons, these dams, they really need to come down. And this will open up the possibility of 3 million more salmon getting out into the ocean for our southern residents to survive on. They need approximately 750,000 a year. So this could really end this struggle, this removal of these dams. So we're out there educating the public, and we're asking the public to get involved, because Governor Inslee actually put together an ORCA task force this year, because he knows that we really have one breeding male left in the population. And so we know that we're really getting down to the nitty gritty end here. So I'm asking everybody to call Governor Inslee and ask him to please support the breaching of the lower four dams. This could be done using the 2002 EIS, which is an environmental impact study that the Army Corps put together themselves. And one of their science findings was breaching the dams would bring back the salmon run. So we're asking them to use their documentation to breach those dams, and we're asking the governor to call for the breach, ask the Corps to call for the breach.
Michelle, why is Oregon impact important for this issue that plays out in the Puget Sound of Washington State?
The reason why is the largest tributary to the Columbia River is the Snake River. And the 50% of the Chinook salmon that the southern resident killer whales are feeding on comes right out of the mouth of the Columbia River. So it's really more of a Portland issue than it is, you know, even a Seattle issue. We live on this river. We are caretakers and keepers of this river. And it's up to us to be certain that that river is healthy and flowing and feeding these beautiful, amazing animals that live, you know, that live at the mouth. And the Army Corps of Engineers office is actually located in Northeast Portland. So we're out for every other week, we're out there, and then the other weeks we're doing outreach. And we've been there, this is starting year two. Tonight will be day one of year two.
I want to jump in a minute and say, one of the things that's most fascinating about orcas is that they are, I want to say they're matrilineal. The mothers and the grandmothers are key of the survival of the whole pod. And it's going to be Mother's Day on Sunday. I don't mean to, you know, mix my metaphors, but just one more time, for anyone who's listening right now, why does it matter that we support these orcas? Like, what do they bring all of us on planet Earth?
They give us an example of what true love and family ties are. They never leave one another. They wait for one another. They live together from the time of birth to the time of death, and they respect each other as individuals and as a family unit. They're an example for human beings. Their brains are larger than ours, and they're more in the social area of their brain. Has more connective tissue than ours. So most scientists believe that they actually feel emotion on a higher level than we do.
Michelle, how do our listeners connect with you to participate with your further demonstrations in the city of Portland in support of killer whales in the Puget Sound?
Well, they can either go to, on Facebook, they can go to Portland Sea Shepherds, Save Our SRKW, which is Southern Resident Killer Whales, on Facebook, or they can connect with me on Facebook, Michelle Seidelman, Seidelman. And they can always go to Sea Shepherd and look up our chapter, Portland chapter, on seashepherd.org.
Michelle Seidelman, Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, Portland. Just want to thank you for being with us on the news tonight.
Thank you so much.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
The Portland City Council voted to stay out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, but at today's meeting, they learned that may not matter after all. KBOO's Jason Sherman has the story.
This morning, the Portland City Council passed a resolution which defines the city's relationship with the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. The City Council, as well as concerned citizens, find the JTTF to be problematic. The following is Commissioner Chloe U. Daly's summarization of why the city has withdrawn from the JTTF.
Do you feel safer today than you did 5 years ago?
No.
I don't either. Because members of white supremacists and other right-wing extremist groups are responsible for the vast majority of extremist-related fatalities over the past decade, yet they don't appear to be the focus of the FBI or the JTTF. and because we have seen law enforcement violate our civil rights, engage in racial profiling to justify investigations. According to the Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism, 100% of extremist deaths in 2018 were from alt-right and white supremacist perpetrators. Unless the JTTF can unequivocally denounce white supremacy and commit to dedicating significant and targeted support to address this epidemic, it's hard for me to believe that this partnership significantly increases public safety. Additionally, I continue to be wary of supporting a partnership with any agency that works with ICE. ICE is a rogue agency whose mission appears to be the violation of basic human and constitutional rights of our immigrant communities. I'm not convinced that there are adequate protections to ensure Portland Police Bureau officers will be walled off from this component of the JTTF's activities, and without meaningful civilian oversight, I'm not confident that we could ever confirm this. Finally, I'm troubled by the FBI's historic and current surveillance of activist communities and the Portland Police Bureau's role in supporting this.
However, several Portland citizens were quick to point out that the resolution leaves a loophole where Portland police may continue to work with the FBI on a case-by-case basis in regards to suspected terrorist activity or any perceived threat to human life. The following testimony is from Carol Landsman of Jewish Voice for Peace, Portland.
I'm very concerned about any interaction with JTTF. It's an Islamophobic organization. While according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, over 70% of terrorist acts in this country are fomented by white nationalists.
Seema Pusaini of Unite Oregon.
JTTF only focuses 20% of its energy to fighting white nationalists. It's not a good organization.
Seema Pusaini of Unite Oregon testifies that although Portland withdrew from the JTTF, the effect on the Muslim community continues to this day.
A South Portland community is recovering from losing their imam. They've lost this imam because of FBI, JTTF, and DOJ harassment. They didn't like the imam, Sheikh Mohammed. So for over a decade, they tried to infiltrate the mosque with undercover agents, informants, and false testimonies to drum up some kind of charges, hopelessly. Over a decade, he was kept on a no-fly list, hobbling his duties as a respected imam, a son, husband, and father. Ultimately, he got off the no-fly list. How? Well, the DOJ offered him removal as long as he rescinds his citizenship and leaves the country back to Somalia. He left on May 1st.
Jep King, representing Portland DSA.
Portland DSA calls on commissioners to restrict participation in the JTTF by at least amending the proposed resolution to change from terrorism and or threats to life to terrorism and threats to life, so that threats to life alone are not enough to call in the JTTF. Threats to life is a broad phrase that would be misused to target protesters. The ACLU has argued against the similar phrase, acts dangerous to human life, since it could be used to classify acts to civil disobedience as domestic terrorism.
And to allay these fears, City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty made a promise to the people of Portland.
If, in fact, we find out this time next year that what we think we have put in place is not effective, I want to make sure that you know I will be at the forefront of making additional changes as we see fit based on the report back that we get. So thank you, Mayor. Thank you, colleagues. And I look forward to Portland being the second city in the United States of America to no longer be part of the Joint Tourism Task Force.
For KBOO News, this is Jason Shermans with your weekly City Council Summary.
This Saturday, Don't Shoot Portland hosts a free day-long workshop on how to archive digital content from protest movements with a focus on any film, photos or documents relating to the organization's activist work. Live with us in Studio 2 to talk about this tonight is Teresa Rayford. Thanks for coming in, Teresa.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, could you speak to what you do at Don't Shoot Portland?
I'm the founder and executive director of the organization. My nephew was killed, Andre Dupree Payton, in September of 26th of 2010, and so I became a community organizer. And after the Ferguson uprisings, following the Trayvon Martin shooting, I became a protester because people asked me to rally. And my response to that was, I'll rally if we can organize. And I'm a big community organizer now. Started the nonprofit Don't Shoot Portland. And we do a lot of social justice outreach advocacy. We just opened up a referral clinic for legal matters that people have. And this part right here is very exciting because we get to document and archive and catalog all of the work that led us here.
So let's talk about this event. So what does it mean to archive digital media?
So like your Twitter page, if you can remember when you set up your Twitter, or if there was a MySpace, or any different mediums that we used as far as social media. Like today, I downloaded my Google Plus archives, which they've, you know, they stopped using Google Plus with Google. But it's basically capturing all of the different digital archives that are relative to like the work that Don't Shoot Portland has done, and putting it into one place so that we can kind of look at the chronological order and kind of really identify and quantify our value and impact of the work. And so 2014, when we first had protests, there were live streams, there were articles that were written. And sometimes I'll look at those old articles on Facebook, and I'll get to this page where it'll say, like, not found, 404 message. Well, retrieving that, getting acquisition of that content, that's what acquisition of the archives is, and that's what we're going to be doing this weekend. And talking about, like, how is that content used? How are your live streams used if you're being surveyed, or if you're just uploading things during a protest? How are those articles used, and who actually reads those articles? I want to quantify that, so looking for those articles is important.
So this digital record is really, it's part of the historical register, at least it should be.
Oh yeah, there's librarians and historians and archivists, anthropologists across the country that have been following movements for generations, and our movements that are happening today are no different than those of 50 years ago. But right now, the content, having the digital access and not putting things in actual print and, you know, boxes, but having them in a cloud or in some different hard drive or device, and being able to convert those different file formats in real live time, that's the difference, I believe.
And how did you come to develop this project?
Well, part of my organizing began at Portland State University in the library. I was working with Felicia Williams, who recently ran for city council, but at the time she was in the urban studies department, teaching about the Black PDX civil rights history. And so when I was looking for answers around like the condition of our community, gentrification, public safety, the removal of people in our businesses, and just the dilapidated access to education, I wanted to find out how was our infrastructure developed to where it would be so inequitable, right? It was like, whoa, I'm from Portland. I know my parents were from here and their parents were from here. So why wouldn't we have the same outcomes as all Portlanders in the last 150 plus years? So looking in the archives is where I was able to discover like racism, very complicit and biased policies and different directives by different politicians over the last 100 years that kind of got us where we are now and helped us sustain the inequity that we all deal with right now. And so using archives to find that information kind of helped me program and strategize our protest. And so now I'm like, whoa, I started in the library, ended up in the streets, took it to like the state capitals, city councils, county commissioners, really kind of educated our community on education and policy and how those things do determine our future based on our past. And again, using our physical and our social media to do it.
And why do you think it's so important to preserve documents from social movements? You said this is something that's been done before. Why do you think this is so important?
Well, we don't want your generation to have to reinvent the wheel, and we don't want you to believe that no one has ever stood up for you, right? I'm first of a woman, right? In 2010, I became the state director of Unite Women, a United National Organization for Women's Rights. And I remember standing on the state capitol steps and saying, I heard people saying, I marched like this 50 years ago and all this. And by the time it was my turn, I was like, I don't want my daughter standing on the front line or protesting for her rights as a woman. And I would damn sure not want my grandchildren to have that fight. But for me, I had never had any information that told me that we had a disadvantage. I had my life experience. I had different circumstances that were communicated with me and my friends. But as far as having an actual resistance to what was happening to us without an education of what's normal or what's right, because normal is not good for us, but not having any kind of blueprint, you know, nothing that established like who I was in the world as a woman, how powerful we were, what our experiences have created in the world to make it better. Those things weren't easily accessible. And I don't want that to happen to this generation. I want them to know, like, legitimately what you and your parents stood for at the time that you were young and where those changes, where they led us and how to stay engaged. We don't want people to say, yeah, I used to march. I mean, we want a generation that doesn't feel any kind of violation by people that are using their voices to liberate themselves from oppression.
I want to ask another question about access. You know, when we think about archives historically, these were pieces of paper that people could hold in their hands. And for a lot of U.S. history, until things became digitized, unless you had money for a plane ticket to Washington, D.C., you couldn't get to any of that. And I'm curious, as things become more digitized, is it more democratic? Is it more accessible? Or are there still these access issues? And is that part of what you're trying to do with this archiving, is to make this the archive accessible?
Well, my first job was at Multnomah County. I was working in the library, right? And I used to do filing and cataloging. And what I learned is that people aren't that interested in archives. Like, they're everywhere. They're in libraries. They're in churches. Every business has archives. Every school has archives. But there's not a lot of people. Like, the librarians will retire, and that's that institution, they hire a new librarian. But I don't think that they build, like, the maintenance or the infrastructure or the system to actually archive. I think that we were set on having folders and file cabinets, and, you know, when computers came, everything continuously changed so fast to where I don't think that paper was able to easily be put into digital print, because the digital formats of how to integrate and aggregate continuously changed, right? When you guys were probably kids, I was trying to get on the computer by using, like, my phone, and I would have to wait for the dial tone. You know, like, people know what that means. You're looking at this man running on AOL trying to get a line up into the internet and hope nobody answers the phone. So we didn't know how important it was to keep accurate data or to take, access to our folders and stuff. And I think one of the things that we're trying to do right now with this archive project is make it normal. Like, I believe that in past history, for the holidays when I was growing up, my grandmother used to have, like, Kodak pictures and Polaroids. And part of us as kids archiving was putting names and dates and locations on those pictures and putting them in photo albums. Well, we don't use photo albums anymore. Everybody uploads everything to social media. And so we have to grab that and put it into some kind of place where we could share it. Because who knows what you were doing 5 years ago? And you don't want to wait for Facebook to remind you. You want to be able to hold on to some of those memories as well. So I think for me, it just feels like it's a detrimental time to get people to realize, like, there are physical things that you actually have that need to be digitized, and there's digital data that you need to start categorizing so that you can have it. And document everything all the time. I tell everybody to do that. Like, carry books around and write shit down. Oops. Write it down.
And what do you hope people will learn on Saturday? Like, what tools can they take away from this this day?
I think that they can find that archiving and digitizing and documenting your social environment and your life, that it actually brings communities together. It brings families together. And I hope that that's something that's my desire, and it is that it'll bridge us and build us stronger. It'll give us more value in our allegiances, because we can see them and we can quantify them. And I think that inspires us to continue moving forward.
So could you speak a little bit about DOC now? Who are they and what do
in
they
the
do?
DOC, Burgess Jules and Meredith Clark. 2017, we had the Society of American Archivists came to Portland, and they did this big conference at the convention center, and they invited me to speak on a panel and also as a keynote for Liberated Archives, Archives for Black Lives. And I got a lot of responses back, emails and different invitations after I did the keynote and the lecture. And it was incredible because there were historians, there were librarians, and there were archivists in those rooms and in those spaces that shared the digital lecture later on. And so many of them started making projects happen that were based on the lecture. And I was happy because all of them were about being inclusive and going out into communities and encouraging people to tell their own stories and to digitize them and to utilize them to broaden their messages against racism and discrimination and oppression. And for people that have doctorates and for professors and all these different industry people to have that kind of access to institutional power and to utilize their positions to get the funding and to start developing the programming, and then to reach back out to us to say, hey, we're doing this program and we're going across the country and we're working with open source and all these different agencies to document social justice movements. And by the way, we were inspired by your speech, and some of this work is happening because of that. Like, for me, that's very exciting because, again, it helps us commend our community and show them the value of what community unity looks like. Like, people that probably only showed up to one Don't Shoot Portland event are going to be documented in these archives because we're going to go hard when it comes to getting a retrieval of it. And part of being on this show today is to let people know, if you've ever been to one of our events, if you've ever live streamed, taken pictures, blogged, wrote an op-ed, kept information on your social media, you might want to come to this event, and you can go to our site and register.
And how should people sign up that want to go on Saturday?
They can go to don'tshootpdx.org and they can register. There should be a big giant picture on there that says digital archives, and it might be also don'tshootpdx